Hi everyone, my name is Eugenia Chow and I run the Instagram account Ugreenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism and anyone can get involved. Lauren Ritchie, also known as It's Eco Gal on Instagram, is an 18-year-old climate activist based in New York City. She was born and raised in the Bahamas, but now studies sustainable development and political science at Columbia University. Along with being a writer for Brown Girl Green, she also runs her own blog where she shares educational content about intersectional environmentalism while simultaneously amplifying marginalized voices. In this episode, we discuss the difference between the Bahamas and New York City in terms of environmental responsibility, Black representation in environmental spaces, environmental racism, accountability, and tips to mobilize others into caring about climate change. Hi, Lauren, and welcome to the Everyday Activist podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Firstly, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. You know, it's a little bit early. I think this is like the earliest that I've been awake in a while. But yeah, I'm happy to be here. Mm-hmm. I'm doing well, thanks.
Yeah, so amidst everything that's going on, what is something that has inspired you today or yesterday, because today just started?
It actually is something that inspired me today just because, like, with, you know, preparing to be here today, I actually woke up like the earliest, like I said, that I've woken up in a really long time, and I actually decided, you know, today would be the day that I watch the sunrise, which is something that I haven't really done in a long time, but it's something that I used to do like a lot when like I would wake up for high school and stuff like that. So yeah, I think there's something that's just really calming to me about like watching the sun go up, and it, I don't know, in a weird way, it kind of makes you like think about your existence in a strange way. But yeah, it's really calming. And I think it's something that just kind of like inspires me, like kind of forces me to like introspect and like, you know, look ahead for the rest of the day. And yeah, it's something that I really like to do. So I'm glad I got to do it today.
Nice. Maybe it's a good thing the interview's at this time.
Yeah, don't wake up.
Yeah. So could you please tell us a bit about your background? How did growing up in the Bahamas shape your environmental narrative? And what sort of kickstarted your journey to sustainability?
Sure. So I was born and raised here in the Bahamas. I'm Freeport, Grand Bahama, to be exact. So I lived here for like 17 years, and then I moved to New York when I was 17 to attend Columbia University, which is in New York City, and I've kind of been living in New York ever since. But yeah, living here in the Bahamas, I was always really interested in global issues and like fixing problems as much as possible. And I guess like the main problems that I was seeing in my country were environmental problems. So I did a lot of like organizing beach cleanups, just because I personally love the beach. It's like my happy place. So in terms of like, you know, getting my friends together, we'd have like fun with it and clean it up. That was something that like kind of kickstarted my journey into being like, I want to help. These are things that I want to do. Even in terms of, I don't know if you did IB.
Yeah.
I did IB, and I did my extended essay. It was actually in World Studies.
Oh, same.
And I did it on the Millennium Development Girls. Oh, that's so cool. But yeah, so from then it just kind of was something that I was really interested in. I had like an eco club that I like was in at my school, and also just like Keep Grand Bahama Clean, which is one that, you know, an environmental organization for my island. So yeah, we did like environmental demonstrations, go on the radio talking about like sustainability. So like even before my journey like starting college, definitely like I was very centered around trying to like protect my island, just because it is like really susceptible to like natural disasters, rising sea levels, all those type of things. So I think definitely like that passion and that understanding, and like growing up hearing that like we're a small island, climate change is going to like really, really affect us, kind of had me always thinking in the back of my head like, okay, let's work, let's try to help the planet. So yeah, that's kind of how the passion kind of started, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think people's relationships in the Bahamas towards the environment differs from New York City? Because I imagine it'd be really different being in on an island as compared to like a very dense city.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's very interesting because I wish I could be able to say that like one really cares more than the other, but I think it's more of a situation where like in the Bahamas, I think we almost have to care a lot more, just because I feel like we see the like damaging effects, like we get, like my island in particular has had like 2 Category 5 hurricanes, like almost back to back. So from there, like, I think people see that, like, hey, like, in terms of like working towards fixing climate change, like, this is something that has to be like high up on our agenda because we, you know, see the consequences. But also, we don't have as much resources as somewhere like New York might. So I think whereas like the Bahamas is somewhere that like is very, very aware of the consequences that happen from climate change and cares about it that way, New York, I've noticed, is more hands-on than the Bahamas is, even though they don't really see the impacts as much, which is probably because like they have more resources, they have money like to be able to allocate to this. So definitely, like, I've noticed that like New York especially, Columbia especially, has like really showed me what it looks like to like really, really care about climate change and work towards it and like, you know, do a lot of initiatives for it. And I don't really see that as much back home, but like the consequences are talked about more. Does that make sense? The kind of duality there.
Yeah. So do you think there's anything that people in the Bahamas can learn from New York City in response to climate change and vice versa?
Yeah, I think just because like, you know, like the US is like, I guess, you know, a wealthier nation or like a more developed nation, I feel like there's a lot, it's a lot more accessible, I would say, for certain people to be able to get into climate action or like using like plant-based eating or like, you know, like ethical brands as an example. Like, it's a lot easier for people to get into that in New York City. And I think because it's less accessible here in the Bahamas, people really think they're like, oh, there's nothing that I can really do. Like, I'm not somewhere where I have access to these things, et cetera. But I think what they can learn from New York is that, you know, there are still small ways that you can help, even if you don't think that that's making a big impact. So yeah, whether that's just like carpooling or, you know, like little things that you don't really think about will make that much of an impact. New York, I feel like people are more willing and open-minded to trying certain things that I've noticed culturally in the Bahamas. So definitely learning that, like, you know, small things can make a difference, I think would make a big difference overall in the Bahamas in terms of the way people think and like act towards climate action.
Yeah. So has your perspective on sustainability or environmentalism changed since moving to New York?
I definitely say in a way that it has. Just because, like I said, like I kind of grew up where people would talk about, you know, climate change kind of as like a scary thing that's going to affect us, but no one would really do anything about it. So I kind of always grew up like, okay, you know, we're scared of climate change. We know rising sea levels could wipe us out, and you get that knowledge, but the conversation doesn't really extend past that point in terms of like, okay, what are the solutions? Something recently that the Bahamas has done is the plastic ban that just started in 2020, which is something that I'm really, really grateful for. But I definitely think there's a lot of steps that we should take, even in terms of like integrating more solutions and sustainable living into like the education curriculum, I think could be like really, you know, helpful, or like just starting from a really young age, talking more about like, here's climate change and here's why we should care about it. And then talking about solutions is something that would be really worthwhile. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've definitely noticed that people don't really talk as much about initiatives and how we're going to fix it as much in the Bahamas as they do in New York. So that's something that's really changed in my mindset.
Yeah. You talked about how you used to go to beach cleanups and stuff with your friends.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming there's like a general awareness of climate change and related issues. Mm-hmm. But if you do have people around you who aren't necessarily as inspired or interested in taking action towards alleviating climate change, how do you usually mobilize them to act?
Yeah, I think the thing that I've noticed the most when it comes to like misconceptions, I would say, about climate change is that a lot of people have the impression that like, oh, like the environment's cool, but like I don't really care about it, so that means I shouldn't really care about climate change. And I think the way that I've kind of tried to break that stigma or stereotype down and like get people to care about it is by explaining to them that climate change isn't just about the environment. Like, it's about, you know, people, it's about your healthcare, your sanitation, your education. Like, there's all of these other facets of it, even the economy and like being susceptible to like natural disasters and loss of life. Like, all of those things are problems that stem from climate change. So I think the way that I, especially like my family and my friends, how I've started to like get them to care more about climate change is like explaining to them that like, while you might not care about the trees or biodiversity in the same way that I do, climate change impacts all these other facets. So kind of, I guess, encouraging more like open-mindedness in terms of understanding that like, you know, there's more to climate change than just the trees. And like, even if you don't care about this, care about this other aspect of it, and then still work towards trying to help, I think is something that's really important in terms of like mobilizing climate action.
Yeah, for sure. And I think recently with the surge of awareness in like the whole Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. there's been a lot of talk about intersectional environmentalism. I've seen in a lot of your recent posts, you've talked about, oh, like a lot of your posts in general, you've talked about how attending school in Colombia, you're the only Black person in your sustainable development classes. Could you talk a bit about what this was like and how it has affected you as a climate activist?
Yeah, definitely. I think, being the only Black face in like a lot of your sustainable development classes, it even goes further than that in terms of just like, not only are you like the only face in your classes, but also like none of your teachers really look like you, or like none of the people in the like environmental organizations that you're trying to be a part of look like you, and all of that. I think it's very easy to internalize like when you're trying to like come up in the sustainability space. You can internalize it in the way of like, maybe the space really isn't for me, or like nobody who's like a leader in this field looks like me. Perhaps like there's a reason for that lack of representation, or maybe I don't belong here. And I've like struggled with that a lot. Just kind of like feeling like an outsider in a lot of my classes. Even just in terms of like what experience, as I talk about like what's accessible, like even like understanding that there hasn't really been that intersectional of an approach in my classes in general when I'm learning about sustainability is something in and of itself. But yeah, definitely like seeing the lack of representation is really harmful in sustainability space for people of color, because like I said, like it's very easy to feel like you don't belong in that space, or you don't deserve a seat at the table when you're the only one there. And I think that's really harmful. And I think it like neglects a lot of very important perspectives that come from having people of color in the conversation. So yeah, definitely something that needs to be worked on 100%.
Why do you think there's so little Black representation in sustainability?
I don't know. I think I actually wrote an article for Brown Girl Green kind of talking about this. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that I'm seeing especially isn't the stereotype that people normally think about, which is that people are like, oh, like, you know, Black people especially like don't really care about the environment, so that's why they're not involved in like climate action. And that just doesn't make any sense to me, just because when you see a group of people, like especially, you know, like Black people and Indigenous folks in particular, who are, you know, disproportionately affected by climate change and environmental racism, and, you know, seeing the impacts of, you know, what climate change does on their communities, of course these people care about climate change because they're seeing, you know, the effects firsthand. But I think the reason that comes in why there's a lack of representation is more so because it's not as accessible for them to get involved in it. So like, even in terms of like, let's say for example, like ethical brands or like plant-based eating or whatever, like they're a lot more expensive, and it's a lot harder for especially like, you know, communities that don't have the same like economic or like social privileges to get involved in these things that again, like weren't really designed for them in the first place due to like the lack of representation that came when it started. So I think especially like when you see, you know, non-governmental organizations that have pretty much an entirely white staff, when it comes to like what their priorities are, they're looking more towards like helping biodiversity, saving the oceans. But when it comes to like putting that same energy and investing it into like, you know, the environmental racism that they're seeing in like communities of color, especially poor communities of color, they don't really have that same energy or drive towards helping them. So yeah, I think when it comes to like spreading awareness in those communities, education in those communities, you know, around climate change, I think it's not really there, which is why I think it's not so much that people don't really care about climate change, but it's more so that they don't see any representation in that field for them to feel like this is something that I could get involved in, or any education on ways that, you know, they can get involved in. And I also think, yeah, there's also an aspect of it in terms of, like, the privilege that comes with, like, being able to focus all of your energy, like, on fixing the environment without having to think about your social issues, which is what I've noticed a lot with, like, starting my blog and, like, being a part of, like, you know, the sustainability community on, like, Instagram, is that, like, a lot of climate activists that I've noticed recently haven't really been talking about any, like, social justice issues, and have focused more on, like, helping the environment, which is fine in terms of, like, okay, you want to help the environment, cool, we get that. But I think the privilege it is to be able to focus all of your energy on fixing the environment and not have to think about, like, racism or inequality or social justice issues because they don't really affect you is kind of, I guess, an overlaying umbrella reason why, you know, sustainability isn't as accessible to communities of color, because it's like, yes, I care about the environment, I care about climate change, but also racism, and there's problems in my healthcare, you know, there's problems, you know, the other things that they have to deal with. So I definitely think it's a toss-up. I think there's, like, a million reasons why, you know, you can see the lack of representation, but I think it all kind of boils down to, like, there not being a space made for people of color to be involved, and that just kind of having a domino effect of, you know, them not being able to see their involvement and not getting more involved. So that's why.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of privilege that comes with being able to focus a lot of your energy on climate activism and not having to concern yourself with all these other social justice issues.
Yeah.
So do you think the lack of representation, has it discouraged you from acting at times, or do you think it's what makes you more determined to act?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I wouldn't say that it's ever discouraged me from acting, but it's definitely, like, that's something that I was aware of and kind of, I guess, maybe think twice about whether or not I wanted to, like, maybe attend certain meetings, not so much like deterring my, like, interest in environmentalism, but more like, okay, if I go to this club, there's like 30 people in this club and I'm going to be the only Black person sitting there, and that might make me uncomfortable. So, like, just having those thoughts in my head of, like, this scenario probably will make me uncomfortable, I don't know, but then kind of, like, it being the driving force, like, okay, but my voice needs to be heard in this space, so, like, I need to be, like, you know, at the table, even if it, you know, feels weird to be the only Black person there, there's a value in that, and, like, understanding that, like, you know, I deserve to be there, and I shouldn't let, you know, my discomfort be the reason why I don't speak up or why I don't give a voice to things that, you know, like, are really important that I think in the climate space. So definitely it's something that I have to be cognizant of, but I think it would be doing both myself and, like, you know, the, like, the Black community and communities of color that I have a chance to, like, give a voice to, it'd be doing a great disservice to, like, all of them to just let my discomfort be the reason why I don't act or, you know, work towards helping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I feel like recently schools and organizations, companies have been rethinking their organizational structures a lot, with a lot of demand for incorporating representation of different colors and also making their leadership structures more diverse. Moving forward, how do you think we can keep companies and schools and communities more accountable in ensuring that they're doing this and also being actively anti-racist?
Yeah, I think it all starts with just, like, continuing to call these companies out and call these schools out and keep using our voices to bring attention to this issue, because I think there are some, you know, like, I'm going to talk about brands and companies in particular who think that, like, okay, this is just, you know, a movement and it'll die down and we can, you know, go back to business as usual. And I think the important thing here is to not let that happen and to not let it become a situation where, like, again, like, Black Lives Matter or, like, working towards, like, intersectional justice and everything really just becomes something that, like, happens for a time, then it goes away, and then, you know, we go back to how we were before. And I think that would, like, do the revolution and everything that's happened so far a great disservice. So I think definitely continuing to spread the word, not letting ourselves be silenced, calling them out, pushing more towards genuine activism, I think is something that's really important, just because you'll have a lot of companies that will do the bare minimum surface level, just, you know, like posting and being like, we're an ally, we care about you, and then still not, you know, putting like enough shade ranges in their makeup brands, or like not hiring any Black people in their company. So definitely just making sure that companies are held accountable, I think it's definitely something that's really important that we have to keep pushing for. It might be a situation where like certain companies might need to get canceled until they get themselves together. And like that might be a necessarily thing that needs to happen, because I think any company that's not willing to hear the concerns that are going on and think to themselves like, okay, you're right, I need to make a change, is a company that like probably, you know, needs to spend some time like rethinking their business model and like what they're doing with themselves, because, you know, that's something that's like very, very valuable to happen right now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely just making sure that brands are like being held accountable, and also that like the allyship that they're showing is genuine and we're seeing some real change, I think is especially important.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a lot of that happening recently on Instagram.
Mm-hmm,
but it's been quite successful, which is good, because it shows that these companies are willing to accept their mistakes, and that's important.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah. Have you ever had to turn down collaborations with companies, for example, because they didn't like align with your values?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. even beyond just like, there have been certain companies that I've wanted to, like have wanted to work with me, that didn't align even with like with my, you know, sustainability ethical values, in terms of like, you know, some fast fashion brands, you know, that might want to like, you know, send clothes, for example. Mm-hmm. Like that doesn't really align with my, you know, my values and like an eco-friendly middle of like sustainable space. But also there have been other companies that didn't have the inclusivity that I like to see from brands, and kind of had the intention of trying to tokenize me, or trying to, you know, not really work towards real inclusivity in this space, but kind of trying to use me as, you know, a Black woman who's also has the privilege of being, you know, lighter skinned or like looser textured hair, and trying to use me as they're like, oh, but we're so inclusive, we have a Black girl representing our brand, but, you know, using the kind of like palatable, digestible Black girl in order to do that. I think that's something that I just don't really agree with. Even when I like go on a brand's page when deciding whether or not to work with them, and I see a bunch of girls that all look the same in terms of like not just like skin color, but also just like body sizes, that's just not really something that I agree with, and not something that I want to be a part of, especially like perpetuating certain things of like, you know, like skinny is the way that you're supposed to look, or like lighter skin, loose hair is what you're supposed to look. And like there are a lot of brands that will perpetuate that type of beauty standard. And yeah, I just, in terms of my values, I think keeping those and upholding those is a lot more important than, you know, a paycheck or clothes.
Yeah, for sure. So how do you usually respond to these companies when there's a situation like that?
I think in the past, definitely, I've just declined the offer to work with them. I think I'll just say, I'm not interested. Thank you very much. Not happening. But I've been doing a lot of like reflecting. And I think something that I can do when it comes to holding brands more accountable, which is something that I haven't done yet, and, you know, something I'm holding myself accountable for not using my voice, you know, to mm-hmm. speak up. But I think in situations like that, and like, you know, to anyone who's like listening who has these type of experiences, like it might not be enough to just say, hey, I'm not interested, sorry, but also to explain to them why you're not interested, and like call them out in that moment and be like, I'm not interested in working with you because X, Y, and Z, and I think this is something that you need to work on, you know, yada yada yada. I think can be really valuable in terms of like what I was saying before about like not letting yourself be silenced, and like using your voice whenever you can, and like continuing to hold them accountable and call them out, which is, you know, letting them know that like, I don't see any inclusivity or diversity in your brand, I don't, that doesn't align with my values, maybe that's something that you mm-hmm. can work on. And at least they hear it, they continue to be cognizant of it. So going forward, I think that'll be more my approach when it comes to, you know, declining offers to brands that don't really align with my values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you mentioned, you're currently studying sustainable development at Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to, or like, how have you been able to apply what you've learned in this course to your real life activism?
Yeah, I think what I was talking about earlier, when it comes to like, you know, my family and friends who might not be as interested in, you know, biodiversity and marine ecosystems, but like they care more about like, you know, healthcare and things that, you know, impact them. I was in one of my classes last semester and we were talking about the approach that we take when it comes to climate action and how it can be possible to like use the same, like use different approaches in order to get the same results. So the example that my teacher had used was like, say there was a group of people and you wanted to stop them from eating meat because it's bad for greenhouse gas emissions, you know, as an environmentalist. You can go to them and you can say, hey, like, stop eating meat. It's bad for, you know, carbon in the atmosphere, XYZ, and explain all the environmental impacts of it. And they might not care at all about that. But someone else could go to those people and explain, hey, if you keep eating meat, it's going to be hard, bad for your healthcare or something like that. Or like you're going to have heart failure if you keep eating red meat. And that might be something that stops them from eating red meat, but you still get the same effect of, you know, the greenhouse gas emissions lowering. So I think that example is what my teacher used, was kind of to show that, like, I think in the past, environmentalists have kind of used a one approach by, like, I guess almost assuming that, you know, everyone cares about the environment just as much as we do. And that's not true. So I think when it comes to like just wanting to get the desired results, it might be a situation where we have to start approach a little bit and kind of appeal to what's important to the target demographic that we're trying to, you know, reach out to. So I definitely think I've taken that in mind when it comes to my activism, because, you know, this one approach, which is trying to explain why it's important to care about greenhouse gas emissions in the environment, and then another approach, which is just like, okay, they don't care about that, but there's still ways that I can get the same results and help the environment and also, you know, take a different approach that gets the same results. So I think that I've definitely kept in mind when it comes to my, you know, activism and how, like trying to get results in terms of helping, you know, the climate agenda and climate action.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been faced with someone who's entirely unreceptive to changing their attitudes or behavior in
all the time?
So yeah, how would you usually respond in that situation?
I guess when it comes to people who are extremely unreceptive, I think for me sometimes it just depends on the, I guess, how close I am to like the person, because sometimes I'll get like, especially recently, DMs of people being like, oh, climate change is fake and you're perpetuating a scam and an agenda. And like, if it's just some random account on Instagram, doesn't even have a profile picture, for the most part, I'm just going to ignore it. Like probably delete the comment, delete the message, just not really entertain it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is a situation where like, say I encounter someone like, you know, in real life, in like a space that I'm like, you know, like in one of my classes, it's not sustainable development related, or like a new friend that I'm making or something like that, I'd definitely be a lot more inclined to like be patient, of course, because I feel like imposing, you know, your beliefs and your thoughts and your ideas on someone all at once can have like the opposite effect. And people can tend to get like defensive or be less inclined to like be open-minded, but definitely like over time, just like explaining to them like, hey, like this is why I'm interested in this. Hey, this is what happens with this. Definitely in a way that like doesn't come across as overbearing, but also kind of makes them more open-minded to the idea of changing some aspects of their lifestyle or understanding why, you know, climate change is a real thing and why it is. And I guess also at the end of the day, it's understanding that like you can't really force anybody to do anything. So if it is a situation that like after my efforts, after I've, you know, shown them some articles, after I've, you know, talked to them about my own experience, shown them X, Y, and Z, done pretty much all that I can, and they still don't want to change any aspect of their life, there's nothing I could really do at that point. And I think as environmentalists, it's important for us to understand that, like, you can't change everybody and you can't beat yourself up mm-hmm. about not being able to, like, you know, adjust certain ways that people think. So, yeah, at the end of the day, I think doing your best is all you can really do. And at the end of the day, it's up to the person about whether or not they want to believe it, whether or not they want to, you know, listen and change anything around. But definitely just being as open-minded and tolerant as possible to people with a range of different beliefs when it comes to climate action. Because I also think it's important to note that not everyone has had the same exposure to, like, me personally, like, I've seen the effects of climate change firsthand. It's easier for me to be like, yep, climate change is real. I've seen it. Not everybody has had that same proximity to climate change to be able to understand it, or they might have been raised in a way that, you know, didn't believe that climate change was a thing. So just being tolerant and open-minded and not, like, jumping and attacking people who don't agree is something that I think is really important when it comes to, you know, one-on-one, especially interactions with people who have different views than you do or ideas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. Your page and your blog talk a lot about how the climate crisis intersects with different injustices, including racial injustices. Do you think you could talk more about how different cultures experience these injustices?
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the main things that I talk about, and that was an example that I used of the Flint water crisis to talk about, like, environmental racism that you'll find in, like, especially, like, poor Black and brown communities. And the situation with that is there's a certain type of environmental racism, one that includes, you know, certain communities being more susceptible to these, like, environmental factors just because of where they're located. But there's also another element to environmental racism, which also comes in with people, you know, not being taken seriously when they bring these attentions up because the government doesn't care about them or prioritize them. And that's the example that we found, you know, with the Flint water crisis, which is where, you know, this community of, you know, poor Black and brown people had been saying to the government, like, hey, we don't have clean water. You know, the water is contaminated with lead, XYZ. And it took almost a year for the government to even, you know, hear and understand their concerns and even start to try to help the problem, even after they've been complaining for so long about what was going on. And then still, that was about 4 or 5 years ago, the problem still hasn't been completely fixed. And for it to be occurring in, you know, like I said, like a wealthy developed nation like the United States, Michigan, like, you know, a developed, you know, state, for it to still be a problem, you know, 4 years later is, you know, a very, very, you know, telling thing of how this community just wasn't prioritized in the government's agenda at all. So definitely when it comes to environmental racism, and even why it's important to have an inclusive approach, is because these communities also deserve to be prioritized in these conversations. And the same thing goes for, like, indigenous communities as well. Like, they're probably among the communities that contribute the least to climate change but bear the most of the impacts. And that's just because, you know, due to, like, loss of land and resources and, like, you know, discrimination faced against them, unemployment, like, human rights violations, all of that plays into why climate change impacts hurt them the most. Same thing with, I think, Black communities. I read an article before that said race is one of the biggest determining factors of whether or not you live next to, like, a landfill, or whether or not you live next to toxic waste, just because there is a lot of, like, housing segregation, especially speaking mostly to, like, the United States, but there's a lot of housing segregation that basically means that the poorest, which are usually, like, communities of color, are placed in, like, the least expensive land, which is normally located in, like, harmful locations. So that's why they're a lot more susceptible to, like, respiratory diseases that come from, like, exposure to certain toxins, and all of that just plays into, you know, how certain communities are more impacted than others. And even further than that, I think things that aren't really included in the conversation are, like, you know, immigration and, like, the refugee crisis and how, you know, that impacts, you know, climate change. Thinking about the conditions that certain people have to live in. I did a project on the refugee crisis in Iraq, and especially everything going on with the water crisis as well, and how the refugees in Iraq are disproportionately affected by the water crisis because the government does not do enough to give the refugees, you know, nice living conditions. And that's why when there's a like situation that stems from climate change, even more affected. So yeah, I think all of that goes to say that there's so many different elements of how climate change impacts certain communities, even like the difference in gender or individuals with disabilities. There's so many layers to understanding that climate change isn't just, you know, a blanket thing that, you know, impacts everyone the same way. So I think that's something that, you know, climate action has to be really cognizant of when they're coming up with, you know, who to prioritize or like which communities need help or those type of things. I think it's definitely important to understand how multifaceted, you know, climate change and environmental activism like really has to be in order for it to be effective and successful and to promote equality and all of those things. So
if you were hypothetically selected to join like the government or something, what is the first policy you would suggest to confront these overarching issues? One policy is definitely not going to solve everything, but like the first one that you would suggest.
Right. The first policy. Oof, that's hard. I think I can't necessarily think of like what specific policy I would want to like enact in terms of like the wording, but I think the problem that I definitely would want to fix first would definitely be when it comes to the housing segregation and the where people live. I think that is something like even reading the statistics about it really breaks my heart. Just seeing how like, you know, these communities of color are placed in such dangerous locations or forced to live in these locations and it's just legal and it's okay. You know, I mm-hmm. think that's something that definitely I would want to like tackle. Also, there's another element of it too, which actually, now that I think about it, might be the policy or law that I want to hypothetically enforce. But I was reading also about how there's certain, like, you know, wealthier nations that will take their waste and just send it to poorer countries. And I just didn't realize how common of a thing, you know, that was for countries to do. And it just blew my mind that it's legal and you can just send your dangerous waste that you don't want to less fortunate places, and then the people there, like, they'll pay the country to send their waste there, and then the people have to like deal with the harmful impacts that come with that. So I think definitely like tackling that, I think finding better ways to dispose of waste or making it illegal to impose your waste onto poorer communities, I think it's just despicable. So I think that's, again, and it's usually communities of color or, you know, countries that are predominantly people of color that have to, you know, face these, you know, issues. So it's all an example of why it's so important to be intersectional and inclusive. But definitely that's something that I'd want to tackle because I just think that's not okay whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So similarly, what would be your vision for the future in the coming like 5-10 years, both personally, but also in terms of environmental action as a community?
Sure. I think for the future, definitely, I think shorter term future, I definitely want, you know, to keep writing, to keep spreading awareness. You know, I just started my blog like a little bit over a month ago. So I think just wanting to keep expanding that, keep pushing out like content and raising awareness and growing that platform, keep writing more articles, both for my blog and for Brown Girl Green, mm-hmm. which is another collective that I write for. I think short term, I definitely want to keep pushing out that content and spreading awareness as much as I can. I think in the longer term future, I have 2 more years of undergrad left. I'm still, you know, I guess thinking about the idea of going to law school. I think a personal goal that might be where I end up going, just to pursue like environmental law, environmental justice. I think that's where my heart is really set right now, but definitely making sure that I like continue to work in, you know, activism, just being excited to learn and grow more in my, you know, field, narrow down specifically like maybe which areas or which communities or, you know, what exactly it is that I want to do is something that I'm excited, you know, towards like working, narrowing down in the next like 5 years. in terms of what I want, you know, the world or the sustainability space to look like in 5 years, I definitely want to see more support towards, you know, Black creators, like creators of color, like creators of color, and also like businesses that are, you know, owned by people of color, just because I think the solidarity that was shown, you know, in the, you know, last week, has shown that it definitely is possible for these voices and these stories to be uplifted. And like I said, I want this to continue, that it's something, you know, that becomes the norm almost, and isn't just like a short-term revolution that people do. So definitely, I think I want to see more inclusivity and representation in the space. I definitely, aside from, I guess, inclusivity and representation, I think I definitely want to see more initiatives done in general to tackle like social justice problems as well as environmental problems. Mm-hmm. And I also, it would be great if we could work towards more like mitigation and adaptation plans in terms of, you know, climate change adaptation, you know, mitigation in terms of, fingers crossed, getting emissions down. I don't know how likely that is, but hypothetically, a girl can dream. So yeah, I think overarching, those are the things that I kind of want to see. Mm-hmm. But I think representation and inclusivity is definitely something that I'm pushing for and that I really, really want to see in this space, just because there are so many great, like, climate activists of color that exist within this space. And to think that, you know, I've been working on my blog for like, you know, a month and a half or so, and I hadn't come across any of their content whatsoever until, you know, the Amplify Melanated Voices hashtag came and, you know, they were getting tagged and stuff, I think is really, really sad.
Yeah.
So I definitely want to continue seeing that, you know, happening and continue that conversation. So that's really important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So clearly you've done a lot in terms of climate activism and fighting for change. So what advice would you give to someone who wants to get more involved with climate activism? And also, along with that, what does activism mean to you?
Yeah, I think my advice, when it comes to pretty much anything in life, honestly, but I think especially it should be applied to activism, is just, I think there's a common misconception that, you know, you have to be perfect in order to be able to, like, be a good activist. And I just don't think that's true whatsoever. I think any change that you can make is a good change. I even talk to people about, like, you know, when they want to, like, you know, start a plant-based living or something like that. And they're like, oh, but I don't want to cut out, like, you know, X, Y, and Z foods. Like, I'm not ready to cut those out yet. And I can explain to them that you can make the rest of your diet plant-based and just keep those foods that you still want to eat. Or, like, you know, there's always ways to compromise. Mm-hmm. But I think the whole idea of like, oh, I can't do it fully or I can't do it all the way, so I just won't do it at all, is really harmful.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, a lot of people steer away from activism, just because they think that they're not good enough at it yet, or they think that they won't be able to do it yet, or any of that. And I think definitely showing that it's more about, like, you know, the effort that you put in and, like, your intentions and wanting to make a change than whether or not you do it perfectly is really important. And I also think that, you know, we all make mistakes. And I think an important part of activism is being able to recognize and, like, be okay with, like, you know, like, constructive criticism or, like, being called out, you know, in certain situations, just because, like, I've even had examples where, like, I've, you know, made a post or something and I, you know, use a term that I shouldn't have used, or that, like, wasn't fully, like, gender inclusive, or I said something that wasn't, you know, like, you know, something else. And I think, like, being able to understand that, you know, not basically being okay with taking the criticism and being called out on certain things and not letting that deter you from activism in general, I think is something that's really important when it comes, you know, to being in the space and, like, working towards, like, social justice issues and environmental justice issues. Yeah, I think that's something that's definitely really important. And in terms of what activism means to me, I don't know. I think I definitely would say that activism is something that, like I said before, I think honestly, I've kind of summed up what I think activism is. I think activism for me just is about your heart and your intentions and really wanting to make a change rather than whether or not you're perfect or you know how to say all the right words and, you know, use your fancy speech or whatever. I think it's about genuinely, like, being sincere in wanting to make a change and being open-minded and being, you know, committed and driven, and doing whatever you can to help, I think is what, like, I think true activism really looks like, for me.
Yeah, I think you put it very well.
Thank you.
And so lastly, to anyone who does want to get more involved with climate activism or learning about sustainability, what resources would you suggest? So this includes, like, videos, blogs, Instagram accounts, those kind of things.
Sure. Oh, there's so many. Oh, definitely.
Your top ones.
Top ones. I would say, shameless plug, you can check out the It's Eco Gal on Instagram.
Yes, for sure.
But also, I think there's a lot of great creators. Michaela Loach is one of them. Green Girl Leah, Waste Free Marie. These are all Instagram accounts that I'm listing. Aja Barber. They're all super great. Love their content. I follow them. And I think they're very, very educational. And also, you can see, like, you know, the genuine nature of them wanting to help.
Yeah.
Which I think is really important. In terms of resources, I definitely recommend Brown Girl Green. It's also an Instagram account, but also a blog as well. And a podcast and a YouTube channel. Just yeah. So much in one. But definitely, Christy and, you know, her team, they make a lot of great content, and it's so educational, so informative, so intersectional, so genuine. It's really, really great. So those are the Instagram accounts that I would definitely recommend. In terms of staying up to date with, like, articles, I think there's definitely a lot of resources online that I could, like, recommend. It just, I think it depends more so on what people are, like, looking forward. I think if you're, like, interested in getting into sustainability and say, like, you know, plant-based eating is one of the first things that you want to look into, I think there's definitely a lot of great, like, YouTube creators mm-hmm. that I watched when I was, like, first getting into, like, you know, figuring out how to maybe be vegan or, like, plant-based recipes and diets. So I'd recommend Goodful on YouTube, as well as I Am Tabitha Brown on Instagram. Oh, there's so many. I can go on all day, but those are the ones that I would definitely recommend. Uh-huh. And I also think that you'll be able to find more content through those creators yeah. that I mentioned, because they'll always be linking, you know, great articles, that type of thing. But definitely just trying to be as much involved in the sustainability space as you can, whether that's, like, following hashtags, following these creators. You'll definitely find that it's kind of almost a rabbit hole that you
sure.
can go down into. And, like, the more people you follow, the more you'll be exposed to, like, different things, meet new creators. So it's really, like, a great space. So I definitely would recommend it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm pretty sure my entire feed now is just environmental related things.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I yeah. love it, though.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was lovely talking to you.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the third episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out. Also, don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.